Hello, and welcome to Kindred Spirits Book Club, the podcast where two grown-ass ladies geek out about Anne of Green Gables. I'm Reagan Duffy, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kelly Gerner.
Hi, Kindred Spirits. Hi, Reagan.
Hi.
So I love my nails.
Yay.
Okay, listeners, we were hanging out at Reagan's house last Friday, and I complimented her manicure, and so she shared with me some of her nail stickers, and these are pretty great. I know the nail stickers aren't like new technology, but I'm very into them. Reagan, I hadn't gotten a manicure in like years, not even because of like lockdown or anything like that, but just because I felt that the expense wasn't worth it anymore after a certain point. But
yeah,
these were so like easy. This might bring me back around.
Oh, I'm so glad you love them. I like pretty nails too, but I'm the same way. I'm too cheap to spend regular money at a salon, and yeah, I don't have the patience or time to paint my own nails nicely, especially because like I hate having to wait for them to dry. And
yes,
because I always ding them, and then I feel like I spend all that time and then they chip a day later, and then I have to take it all off because I don't like it when once it's chipped, I want to pick at it.
Exactly.
So yeah, these nail stickers. So listeners, they're the kind where they're like stickers that cover your whole nail, and they're made out of like real nail polish, and you just like stick them on and then cut them so they fit your nail and just like give it a file. And then they last for like 2 weeks.
You know, we put them on Friday. It's Tuesday night now. They look brand new. Nothing has changed. Like, and I've like washed dishes, done all the things, and they look really good still. And these designs are super cute. Like, I could not have done this. And
that's
if you want
what
to
I
salon,
love.
You have to pay like a nail artist to do them.
Yeah. Like, I love it when it's like the super cute little designs and you can do the fun thing where you've got like an accent nail or two. But
yes.
Yeah. I'm not going to be able to do that on my own. And so listeners, in case you're wondering, the brand that I've been using has been the Dashing Diva brand, which you can buy off their website, but are also at like Target. And Kelly, I'm super excited to go thrifting this weekend with you and my daughter, Alice.
I'm also really, really excited about this. Yeah. So I was thinking about this today. I drove around a little bit to try to decide where we were going to go. And my neighborhood, I'm pretty sure, is like a little bit of a hidden gem for thrifting in LA.
Yes.
We have a lot of thrift stores. Like, I was not hurting for choice. Like, I kind of went to a few different ones to like sort of scope out which ones she might think were fun. And we are going to be spoiled for choice. So listeners, just a heads up, if you are looking for a thrifting place in Southern California, Altadena is your neighborhood.
I am so excited. She's never really gone thrifting before. I certainly haven't. Like, probably not since before she was born. And I'm really excited to kind of see, now that she has a little bit of a sense of her own style, what she might pick out, especially with that kind of budget. You can really kind of play around with things that you might not normally buy. So
yeah, I remember I loved thrifting, certainly when I was her age, but like all the way up through high school. I haven't done it too much as an adult, just because it's very hard to find like good quality plus size clothes in thrift stores. But there are like specialty plus thrift stores now. I don't know, like the world has really opened up for plus size fashion generally in the last like 10 years or so. But I was thinking about it. You know what I do love to do and I do a lot of? Is antiquing. So I think there's like a pipeline. Like, if you loved thrifting as a teenager, you'll love antiquing in your 40s.
Right, because antiquing is thrifting for your home.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And then you never have to worry about size.
Yep, you don't have to worry about size. You know what it is? I'm just realizing this as we're talking. It's the exact same thing as what you're talking about with Alice, right? Alice is a preteen and she is figuring out her style. And thrifting is like an inexpensive way to do that, right?
Yes.
Like, you can try on lots of different styles, lots of different personas, lots of different accessories, you know, figure out what you're into, what feels like you. In antiquing, as an adult, is the same thing.
Right? Exactly.
You're fully out of the just like, I just bought what I can afford phase, right? Like, we just went to IKEA because that's what the budget was. But maybe you're not fully like investment pieces, huge investment pieces for your house yet. Where's that middle ground? Antique stores.
And again,
buy some
a fun
size. See how you like
it. Exactly. It's a fun way to like kind of sustainably play around with something.
Yes.
Because if something doesn't work as well for you as you or in your home as you thought it was going to be, or clothing wise, it doesn't feel as much like a waste because It was secondhand to begin with.
No, that part for sure. And, you know, no hate at all to like the Home Goods of the world. I love a Home Goods. I love a Target dollar aisle just as much as the next lady, I promise you. But I always feel like a little tinge of guilt when I take something home and then, you know, have it up for like a little bit and then get tired of it. And then it's like, okay, well, where does this go?
Mm-hmm.
Did I just buy something that I was just going to throw out a few months later or whatever? So yeah, the sustainability factor of thrifting or vintage shopping is really nice.
Well, Alice specifically asked to go with you, so I am very lucky that she's letting me tag along. although I guess she needs a ride to your side of town, so.
That's true. That's
I got lucky.
Wait till she has her driver's license, Reagan.
I know. All right, listeners. Well, let's leave thrifting and nails behind. And today we are going to continue our character-driven discussion of the themes in Anne's House of Dreams with a discussion about Captain Jim and his unconventional intelligence. As many listeners know, we've been using as a connecting thread over all of our seasons one of the first quotes we hear from Anne in Green Gables. Anne asks Matthew if he'd rather be angelically good, dazzlingly clever, or divinely beautiful. Matthew doesn't know, and Anne admits she's not sure either. In this season, with Anne fully in her adulthood now, we've been looking at how each of those values is expressed in one of the new characters we meet in this book, and how our characters both uphold and subvert those ideas. Adulthood is about realizing how the ideals we developed in childhood look out in the real world, and that's not always the way we expect. So today, we're going to look at cleverness through the lens of a man of deep wisdom, but little formal schooling, Captain Jim.
Let's meet our kindred spirit of the episode. Captain Jim's formal name is James Boyd, but no one calls him that. He's a retired sailor and now the keeper of the Four Winds Light, and he's 76 years old. He and Anne recognize each other as kindred spirits right away, and his friendship, wisdom, and guidance are a warm constant for Anne. If Miss Cornelia is the humor of Anne's House of Dreams and Leslie is the tragedy, Captain Jim is the soul of the book. And we want to talk about the way that Captain Jim both embodies this ideal of cleverness and the way he subverts it. Our quote of the episode is this description of the old seafarer. Captain Jim was a high-souled, simple-minded old man with eternal youth in his eyes and heart. He had a tall, rather ungainly figure, somewhat stooped, yet suggestive of great strength and endurance. A clean-shaven face, deeply lined and bronzed, a thick mane of iron-gray hair falling quite to his shoulders, and a pair of remarkably blue, deep-set eyes, which sometimes twinkled and sometimes dreamed, and sometimes looked out seaward with a wistful quest in them, as one seeking something precious and lost.
Well, let's launch into our story club about Captain Jim. We hear about Captain Jim in passing long before we ever meet him. Back in Avonlea, when Gilbert tells Anne about the little house of dreams, he tells her that there's apparently a romantic story attached to it and that the lighthouse keeper will be able to tell them more in person. So right away, Captain Jim is established as a storyteller and a bit of a history keeper.
Right. If Miss Cornelia is our Four Winds insider, Captain Jim is its historian.
Captain Jim comes to meet Anne and Gilbert at the House of Dreams the night they arrive in Four Winds, along with Dr. Dave and Mrs. Dr. Dave, and he's brought fresh trout for supper. As Gilbert introduces Anne to Captain Jim, Anne and Captain Jim immediately recognize each other as kindred spirits. Captain Jim speaks in a folksy way, and we get some classic Montgomery regionalist accent work with Captain Jim's dialogue throughout this book. So, listeners, pardon us if we don't always get the charm of his accent coming through. Maud is doing this quite on purpose. Throughout the book, we have this contrast between Captain Jim's homespun speech, which demonstrates his lack of higher education, and the deep wisdom in the content of his words. Captain Jim isn't clever in the way that young Anne would think of. He doesn't have much book learning or education. He doesn't use the big words that young Anne loved so much. His speech isn't elegant or refined. But we learn quickly that Captain Jim is deeply wise, and that is the sort of grandfatherly wisdom that Anne gravitates to. Captain Jim tells Anne, "You certainly are a nice little bride, Mistress Blythe. Looking at you sort of makes me feel like I've just been married myself." And he happily accepts the invite to stay to dinner with the Blythes and Dr. and Mrs. Dr. Dave, saying he's glad to sit down with two such sweet, purty ladies. And then Maud tells us, "Captain Jim's compliments may look very bald on paper, but he paid them with such a gracious, gentle deference of tone and look that the woman upon whom they were bestowed felt that she was being offered a queen's tribute in a kingly fashion." This is going to come up often through the book. Despite his wild life as a sailor and his rough-hewn way of speaking, Captain Jim is a gentleman and has a clear-eyed way of seeing through to the heart of things. He's really a man of deep contradictions in that way, both a wanderlusty wayfarer and salt-of-the-earth islander. Captain Jim represents someone whose essential core values are very much of his time and place, but whose values are informed by his natural curiosity and intelligence, and then molded by the opportunities that few people born in his time and place could ever have experienced.
We see him as being somewhat akin to Anne herself in that way, a child from humble beginnings, imbued with traditional morals and values, but whose ambition and intelligence set her on a path unlike that of many of the women of her time. While for Anne, that was higher education, for Captain Jim, it is the sea. On this first meeting with Captain Jim, Anne can't help but notice his appearance. And we get a little contrast also between the way that Anne is obsessed with Leslie's beauty and then how she sees Captain Jim. Maud writes, "Though at first sight Anne thought him plain, she never thought anything more about it. The spirit shining through that rugged tenement beautified it so wholly." Now, of course, some of this is rank sexism. Women's worth is often defined by their outward appearance, and men have the privilege of being defined by their experiences. But it also shows that Anne is quickly tuned in to Captain Jim's wisdom. We also learn about Captain Jim over this first dinner that he is kind and selfless. He sheepishly admits that he's hungry for supper because he gave his midday meal, which was steak that he had just bought, to a hungry dog he took in for the night.
Oh, we love Captain Jim.
If the reader is not head over heels in love with Captain Jim after this anecdote, well, I don't know how to help them. Captain Jim grew up in Four Winds, and he knows everyone. And even Miss Cornelia, who dislikes most men, likes Captain Jim. The Blythes invite Captain Jim to tell the story of the first bride who came to the House of Dreams. And we quickly see that one of Captain Jim's most prominent gifts is the gift of storytelling. He deftly spins the tale of the schoolmaster's bride, weaving in the heartbreak and drama and his own history with the schoolmaster. He alludes to the mystery around the schoolmaster's prophetic vision, and we are told that multiple times Jim pauses and gazes off into the distance, as if he, quote, kept a passing tryst with visitants Anne and Gilbert could not see. We get the sense that Jim is a man who has lived his life fully and wholeheartedly, and now finds his calling in sharing those experiences with others. He seems to be living both for the here and now, but also in community with his memories of the people and places who've had an impact on his life. Jim spends a lot of time in this book, not just sharing these stories with Anne, but in quiet reflection, reliving many memories as his life enters its last chapter. Reagan, you know how we talk about reading these books at different phases of our lives and like just finding nuance and truth in them that we didn't see before as younger readers? I cannot wait to read this series again in another couple of decades and find out all those details that ring true in my older years. You know, I really am inspired by Captain Jim, and I hope, like him, I have made friends with my memories.
I really love that idea, and I think it's true. House of Dreams in particular, I think, is a book that resonates differently at different stages of your life.
Yeah, because we see a lot of life stages in it, right? It's a beautiful book with births and deaths and the whole gamut.
Well, Captain Jim tells Anne that this house has been filled with many happy occupants and that, quote, the walls of this house must be sort of soaked with laughing and good times. Captain Jim compliments Anne's beauty, and Maud again contrasts his speech with the feeling that it leaves in his listener with, quote, Captain Jim contrived to give his sunflower compliment the delicacy of a violet. They end this first evening together by exchanging invitations to visit often, and it's clear that Captain Jim is going to be very important to Anne. We've often talked about how Anne has always been surrounded by older women who have modeled for her all the different ways to be a woman in the world, who have taught her lessons both directly and indirectly about how to live life and what is good and moral. From Marilla to Mrs. Lynde, from Miss Stacy to Aunt Josephine Barry, and Mrs. Allen, Miss Lavender, Aunt Jimsy, the widows at Windy Poplar's. But Anne's only adult male role model has been Matthew. Matthew's model of gentle masculinity, which we explored way back in episode 6, was deeply needed by Anne at the time. His deep attention to Anne and his quiet, unconditional love soaked into her parched soul. Matthew taught Anne that she mattered and was the first person to open his heart to her. Captain Jim is the second man to be a father figure to Anne. Unlike the taciturn Matthew, Captain Jim has no such shortage of words, and we do get to know him far better than we truly ever got to know Matthew. But like Matthew, Captain Jim is a believer in deeds over empty promises, and just as Matthew had a deep respect for the farmland, Captain Jim has a deep respect for the sea. Like Matthew, Captain Jim has never married, although we do find out that he once had a true love. Like Matthew, Captain Jim never gets angry, having a laconic and relaxed nature. In fact, Miss Cornelia says, that's the one thing that's irritating about Captain Jim. Quote, you can't make him mad. I've tried for 20 years and he just keeps on being placid. It does sort of rile me. But whereas Matthew is shy and withdrawn, Captain Jim knows everybody, talks to everybody, and enjoys socializing. Matthew has never gone anywhere farther than Charlottetown, but Captain Jim has sailed all over the world and has a deep pull towards adventure.
I love thinking of these two characters as sides of the same coin, both representing paternal love for Anne. Both Matthew and Captain Jim are also the soul of their books, and of course they both die in their books. I'm kind of playing with some ideas about the characters who die in these books, like, you know, not just the people who we kind of hear about in passing who die, but like the characters who we really get to know and we really connect with and then who die and what those deaths represent. I'm thinking this discussion might go in a later episode when we finally get to Rilla of Ingleside, but there's a through line between the characters who die on the page and the characters who we really see as embodying a sort of connection with the soul. And I think that Matthew and Captain Jim are some of the best examples of this.
Yes, for sure. Just as Anne instantly knew that Matthew was a kindred spirit, she feels the same connection with Captain Jim. In no time at all, Gilbert and Anne are fast friends with Captain Jim. He comes often to the little house of dreams. Like Anne, Jim loves beautiful things, and he admires how Anne has decorated the house. The Blythes go to visit Jim at the lighthouse as well. And there we find that he has a big orange-colored cat named First Mate, whom he rescued as a kitten, that he loves reading the romance serials in the newspaper, and that he has a young great-nephew, Joe, who he reads pirate stories to. And also that he makes a great cup of tea.
So important.
Captain Jim has lots of stories to tell. And the truth is, he's as much of a gossip as Miss Cornelia in regards to the folks of Glen St. Mary's. But he usually has a more positive spin on it than Miss Cornelia. Between the two of them, Anne and Gilbert really get the lowdown on all the town drama.
Oh, I'll say. I mean, Captain Jim knows he talks a lot. And he reminds the Blythes to stop him if ever he rambles too long. But he has such a gift for storytelling that Anne is fascinated. Captain Jim shows Anne and Gilbert lots of the little souvenirs in his house, souvenirs he's picked up in his travels with a story to go with each one. Quote, Captain Jim never said a boastful word, but it was impossible to help seeing what a hero the man had been. Brave, true, resourceful, unselfish. He sat there in his little room and made those things live again for his hearers. By a lift of the eyebrow, a twist of the lip, a gesture, a word, he painted a whole scene or character so that they saw it as it was. Captain Jim also tells them that he's jotted down his stories in his life book over the years, but he knows he's not a true writer. He can't give his written words the same vibrancy that he can when he speaks them. He thinks his life book would be a great book if he could write well. So again, we have this contrast to the more formal intelligence of a good writer that Anne would have coded as clever when she was young, and Captain Jim's intelligence, a sort of lived-in wisdom that comes from observation and life experience. Anne knows there's value and brilliance in this book, even if Captain Jim doesn't have the skill to write it. Captain Jim tells the Blythes that he loves their company and that he's been a bit lonely since Miss Elizabeth Russell, the last occupant of the House of Dreams, died. Maud tells us Captain Jim spoke with the pathos of the aged, who see their old friends slipping from them one by one, friends whose place can never be quite filled by those of a younger generation, even of the race that knows Joseph. House of Dreams is very much a book of beginnings and endings. Anne and Gilbert's marriage is just beginning, they're beginning their family together, and Captain Jim's life is drawing to a close. He's passing on his stories and his wisdom to that next generation. Anne marvels that Captain Jim has such a kindly persona that it's hard to reconcile it with his tales of wild adventure. And then Gilbert shares that he once saw Captain Jim flash lightning at a man in the fishing village who made a nasty remark about a woman in Jim's presence. So Jim has depth. Anne wonders that Captain Jim has never married. He's so convivial and social. It seems a shame that he only has his cat. But Maud says Anne was mistaken. Captain Jim had more than that. He had a memory.
Boy, do I wish we had gotten more details about the wild and adventurous stories that Jim tells over the course of this book. And perhaps Maud thought that those tales were not in her wheelhouse. We only get Jim's stories in the book when they stick a little closer to home.
Right. I think maybe Maud, like Anne, also feels herself not quite up to the task of capturing those more like adventuresome stories. But I'll recommend a few books in our Birch Path and Inspired By sections that may help fill that gap.
Captain Jim's wisdom is especially sharp when it comes to people. He's very attuned to what unspoken needs people have. He often volunteers to watch Dick Moore so that Leslie is free to socialize with Anne. The very first time Leslie comes over, she admits that it was Captain Jim who made her go. Captain Jim knew that Leslie would need a push to take up Anne's offer of friendship. And he is there when Anne sees Leslie crying in her kitchen one night. Captain Jim affirms Anne's instincts about Leslie, and as he and Anne walk home in the ghostly night, we get a little passage that displays his wisdom. He says, quote, "I reckon when the darkness is close to us, it is a friend. But when we sort of push it away from us, divorce ourselves from it, so to speak, with lantern light, it becomes the enemy." Now, on the surface, they're talking about the way that walking in the dark by lantern light is spooky, but Captain Jim has a very wise take on the more abstract nature of darkness. It's no mistake this conversation happens after they are talking about Leslie and the nature of her sorrow and bitterness. We see how when Leslie pushes away and tries to wall up her bitterness, that she becomes cold. She sees others as the enemy. But when Leslie is vulnerable and lets her vulnerability be seen by others, such as when she confesses her bitterness and anger to Anne, she can see others as friends who are there for her. As winter approaches and the days grow short and cold, Captain Jim spends many evenings with the Blythes at his lighthouse. Captain Jim and Gilbert love having long discussions, and we again see that divide between Gilbert's educated cleverness and Captain Jim's lived wisdom. Jim says, "I like to ponder on all kinds of problems, though I can't solve them. My father held that we should never talk of things we couldn't understand. But if we didn't, Doctor, the subjects for conversation would be mighty few. I reckon the gods laugh many a time to hear us. But what matters so long as we remember that we're only men and don't take to fancying that we're God ourselves, really, knowing good and evil. I reckon our pow-pows won't do us or anyone much harm. So let's have another whack at the whence and why and whither this evening, Doctor."
It's so gratifying to see Gilbert's intelligence on the page in his conversations with Captain Jim. I mean, we'll get to it in a later episode, but this is such a great Gilbert book. And Captain Jim is a worthy foil. Gilbert is young and ambitious and naturally bright with big ideas and a lot of schooling. And Jim is in this quieter phase of life with the wisdom of years. The two of them become great friends in this book, where for Anne, Jim takes on a sort of paternal role. It's clear that for Gilbert, Jim is a mentor and role model. Captain Jim also has a diabolical sense of humor and uses it to rile up Miss Cornelia and challenge some of her more outlandish opinions. As longtime friends, he can get away with this more than most. Christmas at the House of Dreams is the perfect example of this. While Anne and her Green Gables family get the dinner ready, Gilbert, Miss Cornelia, and Captain Jim have a hilarious exchange. Jim riles Miss Cornelia about a widower coming courting at her house, which she shuts down with her typical acerbic wit. He then prods her by telling her that he went to the Methodist church the previous week. Cornelia, with her holy terror of Methodists, tells him tartly he'd have spent the day better at home reading his Bible. But Jim explained that he needed to hear some good singing, and that even Cornelia ought to admit the Presbyterian choir had gone downhill. And then this perfectly tees up Cornelia for a little rant about how the men who were in charge of building the church mismanaged it, and the women parishioners had to take charge to see the project through. It's clear that Jim has brought up this whole anecdote just to have the fun of winding Miss Cornelia up, as Miss Cornelia enjoys a kvetch, and Gilbert thinks it's all entertaining and funny. We heard a lot from Maud about how Leslie would set people up in social situations to be at their best, but here, I think we're actually seeing Captain Jim do just that. He's letting each person do what they enjoy doing in a conversation. Anne calls Gilbert to the kitchen to chide him for teasing Miss Cornelia, and Gilbert tells her the truth. They're all having fun, and none more so than Miss Cornelia.
Captain Jim returns the favor of hosting at New Year's, and the Blythes, Leslie, and Marshall Elliot come over for a little informal party.
Reagan, query for you. Do you think Captain Jim kept Marshall Elliot around all these years so Miss Cornelia and he would get together? Was that just another example of Jim seeing what others needed even if they didn't see it for themselves?
Ah, good question. I'd like to think that he's that kind of matchmaking meddler.
Yes.
But I kind of think it's more of a way for us to get to know Marshall Elliot a little bit. So when we get that turn later around Miss Cornelia,
it's not such a shock.
Yeah, we know who he is. Because, of course, Captain Jim associates with intelligent, compassionate, interesting people. And we want nothing less than that for our Miss Cornelia.
No, we don't.
We also get a sweet moment over New Year's of Captain Jim looking at his little great nephew, Joe, who had come over to hear tales of sailing and fell asleep before New Year's. Jim just loves this kid, and he tells Anne, "As for his imagination, it sails away from everything. He makes up the most remarkable yarns." And then his mother shuts him up in the closet for telling stories, and he sits down and makes up another one and has it ready to relate to her when she lets him out. "He had one for me when he came down tonight, Uncle Jim," says he, solemn as a tombstone. "I had adventure in the glen today." "Yes, what was it?" says I, expecting something quite startling, but nowise prepared for what I really got. "I met a wolf in the street," says he. "Enormous wolf with a big red mouth and awful long teeth, Uncle Jim." "I didn't know there was any wolves up at the glen," says I. "Oh, he comed there from far, far away," says Joe, "and I thought he was going to eat me up, Uncle Jim." "Were you scared?" says I. "No, because I had a big gun," says Joe, "and I shot the wolf dead, Uncle Jim, solid dead. And then he went up to heaven and bit God," says he. Well, I was fair staggered, Mistress Blythe.
He went up to heaven and bit God. Gosh, it's such a funny story. And knowing how like young kids kind of make up these tall tales, it's so perfectly observed on Maud's part. And I just love how Captain Jim is so delighted with the world around him, isn't he? He's had these adventures far and wide all around the world, probably lived through more exciting times than most people in Four Winds will ever see. And yet he's just as enchanted with the stories of a little boy. The New Year's party is a glorious night with more stories, music, and dancing. Marshall Elliot tells Jim he'll live to be 100 years old, but Jim disagrees. "No, and I don't want to. At least, I think I don't. Death grows friendlier as we grow older."
You know, I was thinking as we were writing this that Captain Jim is really embodying a human development principle here. So if you weren't a psychology major in college, you might not be familiar with this, but Erik Erikson developed what are called the 8 stages of human psychosocial development, and that's pretty widely accepted as a useful framework. I'm not going to go into them all here. That's a whole other topic. But the essential idea is that each stage of development involves a task of working through 2 opposing states of being that shape personality. And the last stage is called integrity versus despair. And when in that stage, a person is looking back over their life, assessing and making sense of their life, synthesizing the wisdom accumulated, and feeling that they have passed on their contributions to society. And when it is done successfully, the end result is wisdom. And Captain Jim just embodies integrity in this sense, doesn't he? He's clearly spending a lot of time reflecting on his life. He's not regretful, but he sees the big picture clearly, and he's enjoying passing on what he's learned and experienced to others, and he's not sorry to be reaching the end of his life.
Yeah, he's not afraid of dying. He's satisfied with his life. Reagan, I think we need to hear more about the phases of life. Maybe that is something for a future Birch Path. I know I love it when you put on your psychology professor hat.
Oh, why, thank you. Definitely. You know what? Maybe when we talk about the kids in Anne of Ingleside or Rainbow Valley, I'll have some other things to say.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And I think that's a really interesting point on Captain Jim specifically. I mean, I think we would all wish at his age to have his integrity, like in that most literal interpretation of the word, right? His integration of his lived experiences with his values.
Yes, he's an amazing role model in that way.
When we discussed Leslie in our last episode, we talked about how Captain Jim saw to the heart of what was the barrier between Anne and Leslie having a true friendship. He told Anne that Anne's happiness, not just currently, but for most of her life, meant she truly couldn't understand the way that sorrow, grief, trauma, and disappointment had shaped Leslie. And even though Anne had an unhappy childhood, the breadth and depth of Leslie's misery is more than can be bridged by Anne's sympathy. Captain Jim recognizes that Leslie is protecting herself against further hurt the best way she knows how. During the winter, when the lighthouse is not in operation, Captain Jim spends even more time with the Blythes, and Anne grows even closer to him. Captain Jim tells Anne about his cheerful and optimistic attitude like this. I just love this quote. "I've kind of contracted a habit of enjoying things. It's got so chronic that I believe I even enjoy the disagreeable things. It's great fun thinking they can't last. Old rheumatiz," says I when it grips me hard, "you've got to stop aching sometime. The worse you are, the sooner you'll stop, maybe. I'm bound to get the better of you in the long run, whether in the body or out of the body." Now, maybe that is a step too far for most folks when it comes to a positive outlook, but Captain Jim is wise to understand that the way you frame things, the story you tell yourself about your circumstances, that's the key to moving through it.
Captain Jim also lets Anne read his life book. He tells her he wrote it to leave his stories to his great-nephew Joe. I don't like the idea of everything I've done and seen being clean forgot after I've shipped for my last voyage. Joe, he'll remember it and tell the yarns to his children. Jim's writing is plain, not at all grammatical, and doesn't capture the charm of his in-person storytelling, but the outlines of an amazing book are all here. And Anne is clever in recognizing that the book is a treasure, and in the right hands, a writer could take this wealth of stories and make an incredible book from it. Quote, rich comedy and thrilling tragedy were both lying hidden in Captain Jim's life book, waiting for the touch of the master hand to waken the laughter and grief and horror of thousands. Spring comes, and we get this other nugget of wisdom from Captain Jim as he's speaking with Anne about planting her garden. He says, it always amazes me to look at those little wrinkled brown seeds and think of the rainbows in them. When I ponder on them seeds, I don't find it no wise hard to believe that we've got souls that'll live in other worlds. You couldn't hardly believe there was life in them tiny things, some no bigger than grains of dust, let alone color and scent, if you hadn't seen the miracle, could you? And Captain Jim and Miss Cornelia also spar about the devil and heretics, and she accuses Captain Jim of being able to find the good in anybody. And so he does, which is a nice counterpoint for Miss Cornelia to bounce off of.
Yeah, we need some of his joy to bounce off of her
misanthropic view of the world.
That's a good way of putting it. I really enjoy that quote from Captain Jim about the little seed and thinking about the rainbows inside of it. And it makes me think that Captain Jim is in this almost, I want to say it's almost childlike, but maybe that's not the right way to put it. But he's in this phase of his life where he's just like deeply noticing the world around him and the people in the world. And he's not trying to change people or enforce his way of being on the world. He's just noticing and appreciating. And there's like a gentleness to it that's really beautiful. After the tragedy of baby Joyce's death, Anne is racked with grief. When she finally is ready to go outside, it is to Captain Jim's lighthouse that she must go for her first venture. The two sit out on the rocks to watch the sea, a place Captain Jim says is a lovely place to sit and dream. Anne feels as if she will never dream again. Captain Jim reassures her that someday she will dream again, and that the dream of immortality in heaven means that someday she will see her little Joyce again. It's an achingly beautiful thought, but Anne mourns that when the heavenly reunion does happen, Joyce won't be her baby anymore, and fears that she won't recognize her. Captain Jim wisely says, God will manage better than that, I believe. And that plants a little seed for Anne of hope for the first time.
Captain Jim asks Anne, as they sit on the rocks, if he can tell her about his lost Margaret. Of course, Anne wants to know and is sure that this is an important part of Captain Jim's life. He shares that he wants to tell Anne about lost Margaret because, quote, I want somebody to remember and think of her sometime after I'm gone. I can't bear that her name should be forgotten by all living souls. Captain Jim tells the story that over 50 years ago, his sweetheart Margaret had fallen asleep in her father's dory, and while no one knows for sure, it is assumed that it drifted out the channel beyond the bar, and then a thunderstorm sprang up unexpectedly, and Margaret was lost forever. Jim haunted the shores for months, looking to see if her body washed up, but the sea never returned her. And ever since then, Jim knows that Margaret is waiting for him. Even though he can't precisely remember how she looked anymore, he sees her in the silver mist at sunrise, the white birch of the woods, and hears her in the way the sea calls to him. Captain Jim could never love anyone else after that, and he's been faithful to her memory for the last 50 years. He says, all the pain went out of her memory years ago and just left its blessing. This story is a gift for Anne, awash in her own grief, a reminder that Joyce lives on in Anne's memory and that she can survive the grief and find Joyce's memory a blessing eventually.
Oh, wow. Regan, the way these books face grief and loss head on is so special, you know, and especially for its time. Like when I think about the other authors who were writing and publishing around the same time that Maud was, you don't see these kinds of like nuanced depictions of death, right? You either get sort of big melodrama, huge strokes, playing death up for sort of maximum dramatic importance. Or as you kind of move into the early modernists, there's a lot of sort of minimizing death out of a sort of sense of world-weary irony. And I think that is largely attributed to the onset of the First World War. And then meanwhile, I think that Maud's earnestness here is just a beautiful counterbalance to that. death is a universal experience, and with it comes tremendous pain. And part of the job of humanity, the work we're here to do, right, is learning to live alongside death. And Captain Jim seems to know this in a soul-deep way.
Yeah, I think there's something very profound happening in a quiet way with Captain Jim and with grief and death in this book. It really is interesting. I've been kind of contemplating that as we've been writing this, about the way that Captain Jim really frames the importance for him of sharing his stories, so that that's what he's leaving behind, that he's okay with dying, with finishing his life here. He just wants to make sure that the stories, the things that are important to him, live on, right? The story of Lost Margaret, his other stories, that's why his life book is so important to him. And I think that's something that a lot of people are looking for, is how to leave something behind when we go.
Yeah. And so when the writer Owen Ford comes to Four Winds, Anne understands that this man can do what she feels she cannot. He can write Captain Jim's life book. I have to quote Maud directly here. Quote, Anne took Owen Ford down to Four Winds Point to introduce him to Captain Jim. The clover fields along the harbor shore were whitening in the western wind, and Captain Jim had one of his finest sunsets on exhibition. One of his finest sunsets on exhibition. I adore this line. It's almost like a throwaway line, but it reinforces that Captain Jim is one with his surroundings. You know, we talk about integration. We talk about being present. We talk about noticing things. It's like Captain Jim is one with his surroundings in this really interesting way. He's not just the lighthouse keeper. He's not just a retired sea captain. He is of the island itself. He is profoundly connected to the cliffs and the harbor and even the sunsets.
Captain Jim tells Anne about a visit to a friend of his, Henry Pollock, another old man. Henry's wife asked Jim to come over to break the news to Henry that he was dying.
Wild, wild choice right there, Mrs. Pollock. Wild choice.
Jim grimly delivered the news to his old friend and fellow sailor, who shocks Captain Jim by saying he knows he's been dying for like a week, and he was just keeping up appearances for his wife. And because he wanted his son to finish building the barn to his specifications. Henry told Jim that he'd suspicioned he was dying before, but he had known for sure for at least a week. Imagine having that kind of certainty for your own death.
It's so funny. I love the idea that he's so convinced that no one will build the barn properly that he pretends he's not dying just to see it through. The two old sailors shared some stories, including one about Henry getting a fish hook caught in his nose. And, you know, this story strikes me as a little prophetic, because in the old days when sailors died at sea, they were shrouded in their hammocks and sewn in with that final stitch going through their nose.
What?
I know, right? The final stitch went through their nose. I read a few different reasons for why this was. One of them was just like, so that way it stayed attached to the body. And the other one was to make sure that the sailor wasn't faking death. Apparently, life at sea was so rough, that was a potential way that someone would try to get out of their assignment. But yeah, after they were all sewn up and the needle went through their nose, they'd be thrown overboard. So that was like kind of a typical burial at sea at that time.
Whoa. Well, yeah. Okay. Things we learn on the pod.
Yep.
Jim finishes storytelling. Anne and Owen have been listening the whole time. Then Anne asks Captain Jim to guess who Owen is. Captain Jim recognizes Owen's eyes, then realizes Owen is the grandson of his old friend, the schoolmaster, and his prophesied bride. Captain Jim is delighted to meet Owen and impressed that Owen is a writer. Maud also takes a little beat here to explain that while Captain Jim knows that Anne is also a published writer, he takes Anne's writing less seriously than Owen's because Anne is a woman. Quote, Captain Jim thought women were delightful creatures who ought to have the vote and everything else they wanted, bless their hearts, but he did not believe they could write.
Tough look for our boy Captain Jim.
Tough look for Captain Jim. He was too perfect. It couldn't last.
He was too perfect, yeah.
Well, Anne seems to take his casual sexism in stride and invites him to regale Owen with his most exciting stories of a life lived at sea. Owen is captivated, of course. Who wouldn't be? And Anne entreats Captain Jim to show his life book to Owen. Owen sees the possibilities within the life book Instantly, Maud says, while talking, Captain Jim watched Owen Ford from the corner of his eye as the latter examined the life book. And presently observing that his guest was lost in its pages, he turned smilingly to his cupboard and proceeded to make a pot of tea. Owen Ford separated himself from the life book with as much reluctance as a miser wrenches himself from his gold, long enough to drink his tea and then return to it hungrily. Oh, you can take that thing home with you if you want to, said Captain Jim, as if the thing were not his most treasured possession.
I love Captain Jim over here. He's trying to play it cool. Oh, what, that old thing?
Oh, go ahead. Feel free. Borrow it.
Feel free. Don't worry about returning it. But no, he knows he has something deeply valuable in his stories, even if he's trying to be modest. He's proud of the exciting life he's led, and so he should be.
Owen Ford is clever. And even better, he's no fool. And he knows at once what a treasure this life book is. He tells Anne on that walk home that he can foresee that this could be his great Canadian novel if he can just capture Captain Jim in it. Captain Jim, for his part, is overjoyed to have Owen Ford write his life book to preserve not just his fantastic stories, but to immortalize his long-lost love, Lost Margaret. The symmetry of having his book written by the schoolmaster's grandson is not lost on Captain Jim either, and he's happily convinced that the world is unfolding just as it should. He gives Owen a little room in the lighthouse to write in during the day, and he stays close by to answer questions and flesh out details of his own remembrances. They work together to create this book that is the sum of all the types of intelligence, the educated, authorly cleverness of Owen Ford, and the well-earned wisdom of Captain Jim's long life. They both know there is something truly special in what they are doing.
Owen leaves Four Winds and finds a publisher for the life book, much to Captain Jim's pleasure. We also hear another story of Captain Jim visiting with a friend in the village who is close to death, foreshadowing now, I think, Jim's own death, coming all too soon, but also demonstrating his comfort with the idea of death and his understanding that at the end of your life, relationships with friends and family are the most important thing. When Gilbert and Anne quarrel over whether to tell Leslie about the operation that might save Dick Moore's mind and thus guarantee a lifetime of unhappiness and abuse for Leslie, Anne entreats Gilbert to consult with Captain Jim, trusting Jim's wisdom and his compassion for Leslie. This is an interesting moment. We discussed it in detail in our episode about Miss Cornelia, the intersection between what feels kind and what is ethically right. It's often a jagged line, messy and painful, and Captain Jim displays his razor-sharp intellect and profound morality by cutting right to the heart of the issue. In his typically simple way of speech, he explains, "I know how you feel about it, Mistress Blythe, just as I feel myself. But it ain't our feelings we have to steer by through life. No, no, we'd make shipwreck mighty often if we did that. There's only the one safe compass, and we've got to set our course by that, what it's right to do. I agree with the doctor." Captain Jim then puts on tea, and he won't let Anne and Gilbert leave the lighthouse until they are all feeling a little bit more even-tempered. Wise man indeed. Captain Jim finds the perfect balance between right and kind by loaning Leslie the money to pay for Dick's operation. She insists that he take a mortgage on the farm as collateral, but Miss Cornelia tells Anne that he will forgive the debt in his will. He understands that Leslie's pride won't let her accept a gift, but she'll probably take a bequest. Anne and Gilbert's son is born, and they decide to name him James Matthew. "After the two finest gentlemen I've ever known," said Anne. Captain Jim is delighted to have a little namesake in the world. Just like his stories, like his little grandnephew, just like his life book, James Matthew Blythe is now a part of Captain Jim's legacy.
Anne and Gilbert notice that Captain Jim is getting older and grayer, and when Anne visits Captain Jim after her son is born, she finds him quiet and wistful, gazing out to sea. Quote, "He spent a great deal of his time sitting by his seaward window, looking out over the gulf with his swiftly whitening head leaning on his hand. He sat there tonight for many silent minutes, keeping some tryst with the past, which Anne would not disturb. Presently, he pointed to the iris of the west. That's beautiful, isn't it, Mistress Blythe? But I wish you could have seen the sunrise this morning. It was a wonderful thing, wonderful. I've seen all kinds of sunrises come over that gulf. I've been all over the world, Mistress Blythe, and take it all in all, I've never seen a finer sight than a summer sunrise over the gulf. A man can't pick his time for dying, Mistress Blythe. Just got to go when the great captain gives his sailing orders. But if I could go out when the morning comes across that water, I've watched it many a time and thought what a thing it would be to pass out through that great white glory to whatever was waiting beyond and on a sea that ain't mapped out on any earthly chart. And I think, Mistress Blythe, that I'd find Lost Margaret there."
Oh my gosh, I am like about to cry just listening to you read that, Reagan. Oh, it's so beautiful. Captain Jim tells Anne that her son is to have a few of his little seafaring treasures when he goes, and Anne, accepting that Captain Jim knows his life is drawing to a close, recites to him Tennyson's poem, Crossing the Bar. It's a short poem, so please indulge our own recitation. Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea, but such a tide as moving seems asleep, too full for sound and foam, when that which drew from out the boundless deep turns again home. Twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark, and may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark. For though from out our bourne of time and place the flood may bear me far, I hope to see my pilot face to face when I have crossed the bar.
Oh, that's such a lovely rendition of that poem, Kelly.
Thank you. Captain Jim finds comfort in the poem and tells Anne that he also feels there will be no sadness when he goes, for all will be well. And although everyone knows the moment is coming, especially Captain Jim himself, but before that, we get a lovely scene where Captain Jim gives a sort of blessing. Both Anne and Leslie are living their happily ever afters. Leslie newly engaged to Owen, and Anne with Gilbert and their baby son. Jim is over at the House of Dreams for a roaring driftwood fire and good conversation, and as he gets ready to go, quote, the old man rose suddenly and placed one hand on Leslie's head and one on Anne's. Two good, sweet women, he said, true and faithful and to be depended on. Your husbands will have honor in the gates because of you. Your children will rise up and call you blessed in the years to come. There was a strange solemnity about the little scene. Anne and Leslie bowed as those receiving a benediction. Gilbert suddenly brushed his hand over his eyes. Owen Ford was rapt as one who can see visions. All were silent for a space. The little House of Dreams added another poignant and unforgettable moment to its store of memories.
Captain Jim gets to live out his one last dream, seeing his life book in print. When it finally arrives, Anne and Leslie bring his copy over to him immediately at the lighthouse. Jim did not know this ahead of time, so he is both surprised and gratified to see that the authorship is attributed to both himself and to Owen Ford, and that the frontispiece is a picture of him that Owen took one day, Jim in the door of the lighthouse gazing out over the water. The book is titled simply, The Life Book of Captain Jim. Anne can see that Captain Jim is desperate to read his book, to see his stories crafted into a moving narrative by an expert writer and a sensitive soul in Owen Ford. But his manners come first, and he insists that Leslie and Anne stay for tea, and he doesn't even let his eyes drift over to where the book lays. Quote, the life book will keep, I reckon. I've waited for this many a year. I can wait a little longer while I'm enjoying my friends. When Anne and Leslie leave, they know that Captain Jim will go directly to his book and read it straight through. They enjoy imagining his delight as he reads it, and Leslie wonders if Jim will like the ending, an ending she suggested to Owen herself. I wish we knew what that ending was.
I know, right? What did she tell him?
But nobody ever knows, and they don't know what Captain Jim thinks of it. Because the next morning, the lighthouse light is still on, and when Anne and Gilbert investigate, they find that Captain Jim has crossed the bar, his hands resting on the last page of his life book. And Anne knows that he crossed when the sun rose and he met lost Margaret on the shining sunrise sea. His life came to a gentle close, befitting a man who lived his life thoroughly, kindly, and with relish. When we talk about cleverness, when young Anne contemplated being dazzlingly clever one day, we know that she was talking about being book smart, acing geometry, reciting poetry to great acclaim, delivering witty remarks in conversation, publishing her own stories, making a living off her own brilliant mind. And in Anne's House of Dreams, we see that in this new chapter of life, that kind of clever has become less important to her. Instead, what she truly values is Captain Jim's intelligence, his intuitive understanding, his profound wisdom about people and the world, his serene knowing that good days are ahead for the people he loves, and his gentle, humble certainty that his legacy will live on, even though he won't be there to see it.
I'm like legitimately emotional.
Yeah.
This book.
It's such a beautiful, it's so beautiful because while Captain Jim's death is sad, it also, isn't that what we all want from our
lives? Yes.
To have lived thoroughly, to have understood our own lives deeply, and to leave something important behind.
To leave something important behind, to leave a legacy, and to leave community behind. I don't know. Yeah, I'm a mess. Absolutely beautiful.
Well, listeners, we'll all take a deep breath.
All right, everyone. For our Birch Path today, I thought it would be fun to learn a little more about what Captain Jim's life at sea might have been like. So, looking at the timeline of Ant's House of Dreams, which is taking place sometime around 1890, we can surmise that Captain Jim was probably born around 1815. This would have been a hugely significant year for Canada from a military perspective. Two great wars with British involvement were ending: the War of 1812, which took place in North America and in the Atlantic Ocean and Gulf of Mexico, and Britain's war against Napoleon Bonaparte in France, which took place in Europe and in the Atlantic Ocean. So in all likelihood, a young Captain Jim would have been raised hearing stories of great sea battles from the men in his family and community. Growing up on an island surrounded by the sea, by shipping and fishing and travel, it makes perfect sense that he took to the sea as soon as he could. Captain Jim also grew up and came of age during a time period known as the Golden Age of Sail. This was a time when sailing ships were at their most technologically advanced before steamships took over. Sailing ships were large and fast, complex universes unto themselves, with their own unique culture and hierarchies. Seafarers could sail around the world, and it opened up international trade and migration. While we can appreciate the technological advancement that characterized this age, we also need to remember that it was a violent and dangerous time. The Age of Sail brought about the enslavement of Africans and indigenous people and the European colonization of land throughout the world.
And we're still all trying to recover from that.
Seriously. In this era, young boys could often find work and passage on ships. Sort of a terrifying idea for us now, but as we discussed previously, child labor was not unusual in the 19th century, and many children worked to support themselves and their families by beginning apprenticeships in their adolescence. In Britain's Royal Navy, boys in their early teens could be commissioned as midshipmen, a sort of low-ranking officer. This is where families in the landed gentry would often send second or third sons if they couldn't afford school for all their kids. Amazingly, like top-of-the-line Royal Navy vessels, like the really big ships, could have as many as 50 boys on board, and sometimes they would even have schoolmasters for the boys because there were just so many of them.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That would be exciting.
Could you just imagine being on like a huge boat and there's like all these like very young boys wandering around?
Like an eighth grade gym class, but...
Totally. For boys of Jim's class, he likely would have gotten work as a cabin boy on a merchant ship. Cabin boys were usually in their early teens, but there are records of cabin boys as young as 8. Sometimes these younger boys were accompanying fathers or uncles learning the family business, but sometimes not. I think it's kind of funny to think of, like, you and I both know quite a few boys in that adolescent age range. I think I can say with some certainty that all the 8, 9, and 10-year-old boys I know would sign up to be a cabin boy in a hot minute.
Yeah, I bet it sounds great in a story, but is probably less so when you're actually living it. But when you're 10, that sounds like an amazing adventure, right?
Yep. Cabin boys were actually pretty essential to running these large sailing ships, though. Their dexterity was required to get up into the sails and into the complex system of ropes that operated the sails, which is called the rigging. Cabin boys could also serve as lookouts, as kitchen help, as servers, cleaners, and just like a kid in the car on a road trip, they could hold the wheel to keep the ship steady on her course. The most dangerous jobs that these kids did was that of powder monkey, which would entail lugging up bags of gunpowder to the ship's deck to load into cannons during times of conflict. I mean, incredibly dangerous, right? They're literally holding bags of gunpowder, these young boys. But, you know, for a wanderlusty kid like Jim, I'm sure this dangerous work was thrilling. Okay, Reagan, I added to our document today a picture I found of a powder monkey in 1864. Yeah, tell our listeners what you're looking at.
Okay, so first of all, this kid has a very kicky beret on.
Yes, the beret is the best part.
The beret is the best part. And I also think that this style of pants is really popular among like middle school girls right now. So aside from that, but let me tell you, this kid is like leaning against the cannon.
Mm-hmm.
This pose is completely in keeping for, he probably looks like he's 12, I would guess.
Yeah.
But he's leaning against it. He's got his hands shoved into like his pockets. He's got one leg kind of crossed over the other in this very casual way. And it looks very true to a boy of this age, doesn't it?
That was really what struck me the most about it, too, is like, here is this boy in this kind of old fashioned-ish outfit, you know, on this old ship, this funny little beret. But everything about his body language and his face is like every 12-year-old boy you've ever seen. Just
absolutely.
Like kind of full of like unearned confidence and like
That's
a little
exactly.
bit of sass.
Exactly. If we traded the clothes for, you know, like some basketball shorts and a jersey, absolutely. This kid could be any eighth grader today.
Absolutely. Well, and I also love that he's leaning up against this giant cannon that is clearly three times as big as he is.
And he's all just, I'm just chilling here.
I'm just chilling. Yep. I have no sense of the danger. Yep. The age of sail was known as the time of wooden ships and iron men. And as Captain Jim grew up, he became one of those men. Life at sea was incredibly difficult. Physically exhausting work with bad food, bad pay, cramped living conditions, and a poor standard of hygiene and healthcare. Long, dull days were broken up by the occasional terrifying weather event or encounter with pirates. Ships' captains believed in working their crews hard to keep them busy and in employing harsh and inhumane punishments if they refused. I'm going to read a longish quote from the book 2 Years Before the Mast. This was a book published in the 19th century, written by Richard Henry Dana, who spent 2 years at sea. With regard to the work upon which the men are put, it is a matter which probably would not be understood by one who has not been at sea. When I first left port and found that we were kept regularly employed for a week or two, I supposed that we were getting the vessel into sea trim and that it would soon be over and that we should have nothing to do but sail the ship. But I found that it continued so for 2 years, and at the end of the 2 years, there was as much to be done as ever. As has often been said, a ship is like a lady's watch, always out of repair. When first leaving port, studying sail gear is to be rove, all the running rigging to be examined, that which is unfit for use to be got down, and new rigging rove in its place, then the standing rigging is to be overhauled, replaced, and repaired in 1,000 different ways, and wherever any of the numberless ropes or the yards are chafing or wearing upon it, there is chafing gear, as it is called, must be put on. This chafing gear consists of worming, parceling, rounding, battens, and service of all kinds, rope yarns, spun yarns, marling, and seizing stuffs. Taking off, putting on, and mending the chafing gear alone upon a vessel would find constant employment for a man or two men during working hours for a whole voyage. So they stayed busy. They stayed very busy with just like a lot of ship maintenance. And because hygiene was generally very hard to maintain aboard ships, conscientious captains would set their sailors to work cleaning the ship as often as possible too. There's like an old sailing maxim about, you know, you work 6 days and on the seventh day you clean. So I'm just going to do a real quick sidebar about Richard Henry Dana, who I quoted a moment ago. I'm actually from a town in California called Dana Point, so called because it was the location of one of the most memorable scenes from 2 Years Before the Mast. So if you didn't grow up in Dana Point, you might not have read that book, but honestly, I recommend it for a detailed look at what it was like to sail around the American continent in the 1830s. Dana and Captain Jim would certainly have been sailing contemporaries. Dana was a Harvard-trained attorney who took to the sea to recover from an illness and to hopefully recover his eyesight, which his doctors advised was going bad from too much study. 19th century medicine.
Did it work?
They're like, your eyes are tired. Go be a sailor for 2 years. But the book is based on the diary he kept at sea, and it's one of the only English language accounts of life in California port cities prior to the Gold Rush, with all that interesting cultural mix of indigenous people and the descendants of early Spanish settlers.
Oh, that's interesting. Is this standard reading if you grow up in Dana Point? Like, is this what you have to read in eighth grade?
Yep.
Oh,
I did
okay.
Read it in eighth grade. Yeah.
Oh, I was joking, but no.
Exactly right.
Oh, okay. All right. Never mind. All if you are in middle school in Dana Point, then you read this book.
Okay. You have read this book. Yes. I'm not sure about other middle schools, but certainly Dana Point. Yes. So if you're wondering why sailors would put up with backbreaking work, terrible food and living conditions, rampant illness and harsh punishments, I think that's your answer. The allure for many sailors was the prospect of days spent in fresh air, right? Like if your alternative is to go work in a factory, life at sea probably seemed like a fair choice. And with it also came the opportunity to see parts of the world you wouldn't be able to experience otherwise, whether you were a Massachusetts lawyer or a boy from Prince Edward Island. So we know that Captain Jim went to the Caribbean because he was in Cuba when he found the man he believed to be Dick Moore. That trip up and down the Atlantic seaboard was likely common for someone based in the Canadian Maritimes. But you know what? It's just as likely that he would have sailed to Europe through the Northern Atlantic. It would have been a little less likely, but still possible, that someone like Captain Jim could have traveled as far as Brazil or India, depending on what kind of trade he was involved with. But in the book, Captain Jim references adventures that took place in South America and Malay, or what we would now think of as sort of the peninsula that encompasses Indonesia, Malaysia, Brunei, Singapore, and Papua New Guinea. So we know from the book that he traveled extraordinarily far and wide.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, right? And then one of the things that I think is even more interesting about Captain Jim is the fact that he was a captain. Because at this time, ship's captains tended to come from wealthier families, and the position was fraught with bureaucracy and nepotism, and a lot of times just kind of came down to who could afford it versus perhaps who would be the most skilled at it. So here's kind of like the typical trajectory. As a cabin boy grows up, he would be promoted to able seaman, which is sort of like a ship's jack of all trades, right? These are just sort of your sailors who are doing whatever needs to be done. And a lot of people would just stop there. But from there, exceptional sailors might have been promoted to positions suited to their skills and knowledge, right? Like you could become a ship's navigator, or you could become like a ship's cook or doctor, you know, just some other position that required like a different set of skills. But becoming a captain from there, especially for someone from Captain Jim's background, would have indicated some kind of extraordinary skill or achievement, like prevailing in battle. Otherwise, a captain would have to be someone who had money, connections, or both. So I'm really curious how Captain Jim earned the title.
Well, if we had the book, we would know if we could read his life book.
I know. I wish we could. For the ending, if nothing else.
Honestly.
I think Maud chose A Life at Sea for Captain Jim more for the romance captured in popular novels like Treasure Island than for the brutal reality that faced actual 19th century sailors. But I do really enjoy wondering about what Captain Jim has seen and done. In Anne's House of Dreams, Owen Ford says to Anne, "That old captain is a wonderful old fellow," he said. "What a life he has led! Why, the man had more adventures in 1 week of his life than most of us have had in a lifetime. Do you really think all his tales are true?" And Anne responds, "I certainly do. I am sure Captain Jim could not tell a lie. And besides, all the people about here say that everything happened as he relates it. There used to be plenty of his old shipmates alive to corroborate him. He's one of the last of the old type of P.E. Island sea captains. They are almost extinct now." And Anne is quite right. By the turn of the century, steam shipping will have entirely overtaken sailing for everything except pleasure boating. Captain Jim really was the end of an age.
Well, that makes his book not just personally important, but historically important.
Yeah, absolutely. The great Canadian novel indeed.
Kelly, that was a fascinating birch path. I learned a lot from that, not just about the education in Dana Point, California.
The all-important education in Dana, California. Well, I was so excited to share my knowledge. I haven't had a chance to dig that up since I was the same age as a cabin boy.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know what? Your eighth grade English teacher, to whom when everybody was complaining about like, oh, why do I even have to learn about this?
I can't believe we have to read this boring old book.
Right. When is this ever going to matter? When am I ever going to use this? Here's their answer. Vindication.
Vindication. All right, listeners, moving into our puffed sleeve segment where we share some little detail or fun moment that we didn't get to talk about in the main episode. I really wanted to talk about how much I love Captain Jim's humanity and his strong sense of justice. There's a scene when Captain Jim, Miss Cornelia, Anne, and Gilbert are all sitting down to eat cherry pie. Delicious. And Miss Cornelia says she hasn't had cherry pie all summer because the Gilman boys have stolen all her cherries. I'm just laughing right there because it's like, I don't know why that kept you from eating other cherry pies, but whatever, whatever, Miss Cornelia. Captain Jim rushes to the boys' defense, telling her, "You shouldn't say that about those two poor motherless Gilman boys unless you've got certain proof. Just because their father ain't none too honest isn't any reason for calling them thieves. It's more likely it's been the robins took your cherries. They're terrible thick this year." "Robins," said Miss Cornelia disdainfully. "Huh. Two-legged robins, believe me." "Well, most of the Four Winds robins are constructed on that principle," said Captain Jim gravely. Hilarious. Robins do have two legs. Jim.
What I love is that Miss Cornelia is like, "I concede your point." She knows she's been beaten on that one.
She just like eats her pie.
Well, my puff sleeve moment is that, like many of the best people, Captain Jim loves animals, and his sense of justice also comes out when he's talking about the thoughtlessness of vacationing city people who get kittens for the summer to play with and then leave them to starve or freeze to death when they leave in the fall.
He tells a story about finding some starving kittens and realizing that he knew who had kept the mother cat over the summer. And so when that woman returned the next summer, he went over and raked her over the coals, deservedly so. As someone who does a fair amount of kitten rescues, that type of story is all too common still. And so I applaud you, Captain Jim.
Reagan, I think we need to start adding some like kitten rescue pictures to the Instagram account. I'm pretty sure all the Kindred Spirits would love to see them.
Well, kitten season has not kicked into gear yet around here, so I don't have any in the moment, but next batch, because they are pretty adorable.
They really are. So for this episode, we are going to be inspired by Captain Jim, and my inspired by Captain Jim recommendation is the Aubrey Maturin series by Patrick O'Brien, otherwise known as the Master and Commander series. So this is a 21-book series about a 19th century sea captain, Jack Aubrey, and his best friend and ship surgeon, Stephen Maturin. You guys, this is my husband's favorite book series. This is like his Anne of Green Gables. He has probably read and reread these books 50 times. I've only read the first 5, maybe 6 books, but they really are great reads, full of rollicking good seafaring fun, lots of adventures, a little bit of romantic mishaps and intrigue, a few sea battles, some light piracy, and plenty of incredible stories from places all over the world. So it is historical fiction set during the Napoleonic Wars, and they really capture the age of sail in a fun and captivating way. And then the movie Master and Commander, which has Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany in it, that's based on a couple of these books kind of all mashed together. And honestly, it's great too. I'm pretty sure Captain Jim's life book reads just like the Aubrey Maturin books.
That is an amazing recommendation. And I'm going to use your inspired by as a jumping off point for mine. And the books I'm going to say are my inspired by Captain Jim are books that we've referenced in the past, although not specifically in an inspired by section. So, listeners, if you heard Kelly talk about Master and Commander and thought, gosh, those books do sound cool, but you know what they are missing? Dragons.
I know where this is going.
That's right. I'm going to recommend the Temeraire books by Naomi Novik. We have mentioned them in the past when we've talked about Iron Flame and Fourth Wing, but they actually fit much better here.
Yeah.
So if you take the Napoleonic Wars as your setting and then you add dragons, which function as the air force during this time for all of the major players in the Napoleonic Wars. And the men who ride them are treated much like sailors on ships. So the dragons have a captain who has bonded with a specific dragon. And then depending on the dragon size, they're staffed by whole crews for immense air battles. So you've got the military stuff happening. You've got gripping fight scenes that are in the air, English politics and manners, and also dragons.
These books are so fun, you guys. I love this series.
Right. Captain Jim might possibly have been mystified by the fantasy element of the dragons, but he would probably have loved these thrilling adventure tales. And yes, listeners, Kelly and I and both of our husbands were obsessed with this series for a while. Was that during the pandemic we were all reading all these?
I think we were. I want to say it was right before, but yeah, I would say there was a time when all four of us were reading them more or less at once. And we were just like, it had a chokehold on our friend group.
Really? There was just, they were fun because there was an element for each of us in this series that we were drawn to. We loved it so much. We even played like a D&D like role-playing game based on this world, which honestly included one of the most fun role-play scenarios I've ever done. So you don't have to go that deep in it, but if you at all like, it's funny because it's a fantasy world that reads much more like historical military fiction.
Yep.
You wouldn't think that combination works.
And it works beautifully.
It works beautifully. These are not romantasy books.
No, okay, no.
If you read Fourth Wing and loved the romance aspect of it, this is not what's happening here. But if you wanted more dragon battles.
Yep.
This is your
more dragon battles, books. More military pomp. This is your book.
Yep. I can't recommend these books enough. So now you guys, between the 9 books of the Temeraire series and the 21 books of the Master and Commander series, you guys are set for a while.
Yeah, you are set for a while. Enjoy 2024, you guys. Oh, kindred spirits. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into Captain Jim. In our next episode, we are going to have so much fun dishing about all the romance in Anne's House of Dreams. After all the buildup in the four preceding books, there's a lot of catharsis in Anne and Gilbert's beautiful wedding. And then, of course, Leslie's romantic arc is absolutely gorgeous as well. We are also going to have a guest, and we cannot wait to introduce you to her. We would love it if you continue to share the podcast with the kindred spirits in your life. Let us know if you've reviewed the podcast on Apple Podcasts or if you've shared about us on social media, and we will send you a high-quality vinyl KSBC sticker. It looks just like our logo, and it is totally perfect, if I do say so myself. Reach out and let us know how you shared the pod via email at kindredspirits.bookclub@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram at kindredspirits.bookclub. Be sure to give us a follow on Instagram while you're there. We are always posting fun, bookish content. We're both there pretty regularly, so it's a great way to interact, get recommendations, and see pictures of our ever-growing collections of Anne books. Thanks for listening, Kindred Spirits.
Bye, Kindred Spirits.